I record these things just so I can be held accountable. Let me start by saying I didn't expect quite that this would be the talk preceding my talk, because in a sense I'm going to take this in a totally opposite direction. And in particular, if you want to get a sense of where the contradiction is going to be here, just at the outset, because I don't want to dwell on John's talk, is that the kinds of things that I'm going to be talking about presuppose that there aren't fixed needs, that there is no pyramid, right? That there's quite a lot of fluidity all around with regard to how we interpret what it means to get better. And so when, Stephen, you were the one who contacted me, I guess, initially about this, you know, how do I relate to this topic, right? The thing that came to my mind, given my own research, is this business of adaptive preference formation. Maybe many of you are psychologists, it seems. I mean, this is something from social psychology, Leon Festinger, and cognitive dissonance theory. And basically, it's the idea of how do people reach some sort of you might say, sort of stable worldview as a result of some kind of very negative incident shattering their assumptions about how the world works, right? And people kind of regroup in various ways, and there's a whole line of work about this, and I'm going to make some allusions to it. And one of the things that I think is worth thinking about in the context of this kind of research and this way of thinking about things, about how one maintains resolution in the face of very strong challenges to what you've assumed in the past, is that you engage in a process of not changing your values, but value clarification. And you start to, as it were, rethink what is exactly, you know, is what has offended my sensibility really essential to what I really believe? Or is there, you know, and is there some way of regrouping my value system so as to accept what's happened outside, but nevertheless go forward with largely what I think is really important and what I believe? Okay? Now, I should say, for those of you who actually know something about this literature, adaptive preferences are usually seen as very negative things. Not facing reality, right? Usually religious cults are the things one talks about in this context. But for me, where I enter into this subject is that actually a bit of my doctoral dissertation, if you can believe it, way back then in 1985, and actually it appears in part of my first book, Social Epistemology, is about thinking about the history of science as one long adaptive preference formation. Okay, where there's a sense in which throughout the entire history of modern science, and maybe John will resonate to this, though I'm going to give a positive spin to it, right? There have been all kinds of disappointments and disasters and so forth associated with both the pursuit and appliance of science, but people carry on, right? With more gusto, with more commitment, but more specific. Okay, and if you don't know quite what I'm talking about, think about what happened to genetics research after World War II. It didn't disappear. You know, one could have said, you know, those religious guys were right. We should be messing around with nature because someone then will want to control, you know, the population distribution of the planet. No, that didn't happen. No, instead what we got was the UNESCO Declaration on Race, which then makes some very careful distinctions about, you know, that race is not a relevant category for understanding human beings, but that doesn't mean genetics is invalidated. It can go on, right? And that's been, you know, and that is kind of how has been, you might say, the collective response to the history of science since the time of the scientific revolution. There have been all kinds of disasters, but nevertheless, there's always been a kind of regrouping and a moving forward, as it were, admitting the disaster, but limiting its damage. Okay? You know, and you can sort of, and I think this is kind of the spirit in which to think about this. What's actually going on in this process? Because I would like to say the history of science has been pretty successful in engaging in this massive kind of adaptive preference formation so far. Okay, in other words, really taking on board the disasters and the damages, but really containing them and using it as an excuse or an exercise or an opportunity to engage in deeper value clarification about what it is that you really are committed to here. Because it's quite clear you cannot continue as you have been in the past. You've got to leave this, you know, this sort of stuff the Nazis were doing behind. And a lot of the discourse surrounding it, a lot of maybe the theories around and the explanations, you've got to leave that behind. But don't you want to preserve something from this? And if that's the case, what do you take forward? And the history of science has been very good, it seems to me, if you look at it as a whole and as a sort of large-scale social phenomena, in this kind of form of collective social psychology. Now, people may disagree. I know there are people who disagree and think that, or now, you know, your time's going to run out, this is not going to work forever, etc., etc. But I do think I would put this on board as a kind of interesting thing. And When I was originally doing this kind of research now, you know, whatever, 25 years ago or more, you know, if you look at Leon Festinger's book When Prophecy Fails, which is kind of the canonical text on adaptive preferences, published in 1956, it was a kind of a big deal when it came out, and in the last 2-3 years it's come out in kind of reprinted edition with new introduction. What the case study, original case study, kind of launched this kind of thinking was about this cult that was kind of a bit related to Scientology, if you know something about those guys. But they were a very esoteric cult, not very well publicized, and they claim that they were getting messages from planet Clarion, which is normally understood to be a small town in Pennsylvania, which they believed, which said to them that the world was going to be destroyed within a certain period of time, right? A specific day, actually. A specific time. And they publicized the prediction. So here's this cult that up to this point had been just talking amongst themselves and so forth, publicizing this prediction. And they believed they were kind of, you know, that this was good stuff because they believed in this thing, what's called automatic writing in psychology, right, where you somehow, you know, like in a trance and the you know, the external forces are actually moving the pen for you, right? Well, what happens is that, of course, this doesn't happen, right? It doesn't come to pass. The world's media is engaged in it. And it's interesting how they respond to it. And I think sometimes people don't quite realize what they actually did, because I think this is, in a sense, part of what goes on. They, for the first time, start publicizing what their beliefs are, their background beliefs, why they thought this in the first place. They start engaging the massive proselytizing campaign in the way they hadn't done before. Right, they want to get lots of people involved to think about the kinds of issues they're concerned about, right, the kind of view of the world they have. I mean, I'm not saying these guys obviously weren't that successful in doing it, but it's an interesting kind of response, right? Because one of the things that clearly happened on the occasion was these people started to get, you know, they got to wake up. What do we stand for here at this point? If this thing that we, you know, that's the only thing we've publicized to the world is false, well, what are we about? Well, we're actually about this other stuff that we didn't tell people about beforehand, right? That we kept away because what? We were somehow embarrassed by it or something, or we didn't think anyone would believe it? Well, now we're forced to, as we're, account for ourselves. And what we're going to do is give a more articulate account of what it is we actually believe so we can carry forward. And see, this is actually what happens when you get these kinds of things in the history of science. Okay? And if we could shift the focus a little bit in the history of science from, let's say, you know, treating something like what happened in World War II as some kind of test case for the future of genetics, which is kind of what I made initially. Actually, my dissertation and the work I did in social epistemology, what I was focused on mostly was on the kind of conception of scientific revolutions you get in Thomas Kuhn. Okay, and because there, you see, if you recall this idea, right? The idea here is that a paradigm is pursuing a certain kind of strategy of trying to understand the world in a very consistent way, in terms of a fairly well-defined theory with fairly well-defined methods. What's a good problem? How do you solve them? You have a clear sense of where the research frontier is at any given time. But then after a while, you get all of these anomalies that you cannot solve by these paradigmatic methods, and so you're put into, quote, crisis, right? This Kuhn's word, crisis, and then you have to figure out where do we go from here. Okay, and the point about the idea of revolution here is that you make, in a way, some kind of clean break. Okay, but the clean break isn't, as it were, to some radically different state in the sense that you just junk everything you've ever believed before. What you do is you reconfigure the salvageable stuff, and you forget about the stuff that's not salvageable. And you forget about it in a very serious way. And this is kind of part of what was interesting to me, and Kuhn makes a big deal about, is it gets written out of the history. So one of the reasons why we don't normally think about the history of science as one long adaptive preference formation is that when they rewrite the history after the paradigm shift has taken place, they ignore all of the drama that went on before, and they make it look like where we're going now is where we always were trying to go. Okay, and this is, and in fact, this kind of distinction was one of the things that in the 1950s, when Kuhn was cooking up these ideas, was helping to legitimate the distinction between the kind of history of science that scientists, let's say, would tell themselves and their students in the first chapter of textbooks and things like this, which is this very continuous history of progress, and, you know, if you want to really understand how things are, you know, now you can see it as, you know, having solved the problems that all those guys in the past were trying to do, and it's all been very steady progress that way, versus the kind of history of science historians tell, right? So you're getting a kind of professionalization of history of science as a field in this time, where the historians are the ones who are actually the ones who bring back all the forgotten stuff. They bring back the mess. They bring back the trauma. Right, and of course, if you take that view seriously of the history of science, the history, you know, then the history of science looks like it's going in every which way direction, depending upon the circumstances. It doesn't look like this steady kind of thing moving toward progress, but just lurching, you know, as it were, from one way to another, depending upon the forces involved at the moment. So it doesn't look so impressive as a kind of self-repairing cognitive strategy, you might say. Okay, and this persists to this day, of course, and so we got, as it were, these parallel conceptions of the history of science that exist together. You know, one that, as it were, smooths over the transitions and say, well, you know, really, yes, there was this amazing moment, you know, when Einstein refuted Newton, but that just forced us to think more deeply about what our assumptions really were, and we've carried on with the stuff that we can still carry on with, and we've moved forward with the other stuff. So, in fact, this was the best thing that could have happened to us. Okay. And scientists, of course, will say this with a straight face, and I think we sort of understand that history of science as being something, that's a reasonable way of thinking about the history of science. You know, rather than saying, oh, come on, you guys. You know, you basically were forced to do this because you were banking everything on this Michelson-Morley experiment, and it just didn't work for you. And so now you're just rewriting history, which is literally what they are doing. But somehow we excuse that psychologically in the case of the scientists, but when it comes to a cult or something like this, we don't. Okay, now it might have something to do with how many people are invested in this. And this is where I go back to the point that one of the things that the cult tried to do after, you know, it was falsified in its prediction was to try to convert everybody. But they didn't succeed because people didn't buy into their principles and assumptions. They couldn't feed into it in various ways. Whereas, of course, science is always actively converting us, and we're all part of the mix, and there's a sense in which, you know, understanding the history of science is sort of like understanding sort of the vanguard of the history of society in general. Okay? And so there's a sense in which a lot of people, even people who don't really understand the scientific theories very well, have a lot invested in keeping that story going. And so there is a sense in which one wants to see this kind of adaptive preference thing move along smoothly. Okay? And my point, and this is the point that I raised in my PhD, it's something I've raised throughout my career in this field, this interdisciplinary field that I'm normally seen as part of, called science and technology studies, this came out in the science wars of the 1990s, if you lived back then, but I'll get to that in a second, is that how do you provide a kind of normative justification, you know, in other words, trying to think that what you're doing when you're doing science is good or getting better or anything of that sort, once you take on board in a serious way the historian's accounts of the history of science. In other words, that it's in fact been this very fitful thing, moving in many different directions, there's been a lot of, you know, not only benefits, but a lot of costs along the way, you know, really radical costs in many cases, right, which get kind of airbrushed out of the record or in some way marginalized from the canonical accounts. What if you were to take all those things on board, you know, and actually say, yes, we're going to take responsibility for these things. You know, this is part of the history too. Then how do you go forward? That's a tricky question, you see. And in a sense, what got called the science wars in the 1990s, you know, with Alan Sokol and his famous hoax, I don't know if you're familiar with this. Some of you must be familiar with this. How many of you have heard of Alan Sokol? Okay, enough of you. That's interesting. Not that many of you have. Okay. Well, I mean, what was going on there in the 1990s was a lot of the kind of research in the field that I'm part of started getting quite a lot of public visibility. So in other words, all these people who were demystifying the history of science, as it were, start to get public visibility and start to seem to be influencing policymakers and so forth with regard to science. So people, you know, you start to get the odd politician saying, well, science is just another social practice. You know, it has some ups and downs, and there's not this kind of thing that's leading it forward, always getting better, etc. Right? So we should be a bit kind of cautious about what we think about what any scientist says about something at a given moment. They could be wrong. They could be radically wrong. They have been in the past. Why won't they be in the future? Okay? And so the science wars, in a way, kind of created, you know, in a way, it's a response to that kind of atmosphere that our field was creating. And so then there was this spoof, which basically, you know, was published in a major cultural studies journal in the United States, which by a physicist, which basically did a kind of very clever imitation of the style of the research done in my field, but was completely fraudulent. Okay, just put it, long story short, it got an enormous amount of publicity, and it was very bad news for everybody concerned, et cetera, et cetera. But nevertheless, having said that, still more, you know, we're in a period now where more and more people are learning about these alternative histories of science and realizing that science has not been this one single continuous path, you know, of self-correcting progress, right? They realize there's all this other stuff going on there. And so the question still remains on the table. I mean, the question that I was posing, you know, during the science wars, namely, once you do take on board that, in a sense, what the history of science does as a collective enterprise isn't so different from what Festinger and his colleagues were talking about, but on a massive scale, and it works when they do it, right? So in other words, they succeed at what those guys were actually trying to do. So they have converted a lot of people after the negative events. They keep on going forward. What does that make it, you know, what does that make us think? How much more time do I have? Oh, fine. Okay. I actually think this is very interesting, an interesting problem. I mean, it's one of those problems that's, you might say, in the background of my mind all the time, because I think in a way this is the ultimate question about how you define normative horizons, you know, about what progress is at the end of the day. Because certainly, you know, no matter how staunch a supporter of progress you are with regard to science, you have to realize that we really don't do the balance sheet properly. We really stress the benefits, and we really report the costs. If one really wanted to look at it from a sort of cost accounting standpoint, okay. But nevertheless, we go forward, okay. And I do think this is a faith-based position, frankly. I do believe that, and I think it's very much rooted in the Abrahamic tradition, so the opposite tradition from which my distinguished colleague was coming from. And I do think that that's very much part of the story. but I want to shift the focus a little bit in the remaining time I have, because I want to give another context where I think adaptive preference formation is also very active and relates more directly to John's talk. And this has to do with the manufacture of desire, okay? And here I think, and this is something actually I did bring up in my PhD and have brought up in several contexts subsequently, is the similarity between the process that I've just been describing with regard to science and what you might say has been the history of capitalism with regard to using something like the idea of creative destruction to stand for something like revolution. Okay, creative destruction is this phrase from Joseph Schumpeter, and it's basically a description of what an entrepreneur does. Okay, an entrepreneur is actually his coinage, and this is in the first decade of the 20th century. This is a guy who creatively destroys markets. And what that means, what it means to creatively destroy a market, is to get people to realize that the kinds of things that they've wanted in the past could in fact be satisfied and enhanced by going in a completely different direction. Okay? So what you do is a good entrepreneur is someone who's able to take an already existing product, including, you know, especially one that's already selling well, and disaggregate, as it were, the desirable properties from it, from the thing itself. Okay? And then take those properties, if not to enhance them, and put them into something else, which he's then providing. Okay? Now, of course, there is a cost. And the cost is, of course, that the original thing also had some other properties, perhaps, that were desirable, but those get negated. And they disappear. And so the obvious example for Schumpeter of this kind of process, and I think it's always good to keep it in mind, is the automobile as a replacement of horse, as a mode of transport, right? Because people want to get around. They want to get around reliably, okay? And car versus horse. Now, car wins. Obviously, some things are lost by horse losing. Okay, so for example, the idea of the role of the oneness with the environment, which is one of the things that, in fact, people who are anti-automobile were bringing up back in the early 20th century, when Henry Ford was doing his business. They were saying, "Well, come on, who would ever buy this kind of mechanical gizmo that just smells up the place and all the rest of it? Even if it does work well, because you're just contained. You're in this thing, right?" You're not out there with nature. You're not able to feel the full force. Well, that value went by the wayside. It became a kind of boutique value, Right? It didn't become a mass value. You know, so it's located, you know, Northern California, as we heard from Rozak. I mean, and that's pretty much what happened to that value, right? But that was a value that used to be part of the mix of values with regard to what you want out of a mode of transport. You want some kind of appropriate relationship with your environment that's kind of open to it, rather than climate control, as we now think about it, now that we've gone down this route of the car. Right now, we're it's not so much that we kind of ignore the environment, we actually want to manufacture a new environment inside this space. And that then becomes the basis on which to judge the vehicle. Now, you see, this is what, for Schumpeter, this is kind of, in a way, the sort of a really interesting feature about capitalism from the standpoint of transforming human self-understanding, right? Because in a sense, what capitalism, you know, we often think about capitalism as kind of fetishizing objects. You know, we talked about the phone and all these kinds of things. Everybody needs a new thing. But I think in a way, that's kind of the wrong way around. Because all those new things are designed to be obsolete. Right? So in other words, you're not really meant to fetishize them in the original sense of fetish that you want to keep this object around forever to worship like a god. It's not that. Right? Because the whole point is you want to be moving, you want to cycle through products. Right? And Schumpeter, in his History of Economic Analysis, you know, he's not the only one, but he does it in a very kind of deep way, shows the continuity between certain kinds of Christian notions of resurrection and, you know, this idea of getting beyond the body and so forth is very intimately involved with this kind of process where you don't hang on to a particular body. And of course, now we're living in the world, you know, I have this new book out called Humanity 2.0 where we're not even supposed to hang on to our bodies. We're supposed to sort of find some other place to be. Okay? And that's very interesting because as you move from one embodiment to another, whether we're talking about our physical bodies, which is rather radical, but even as we move, you know, from the material things that we're using and define our environment around us, and we're moving from one to the other and so forth, and what's happening is our value space is being configured, right? We're engaged, you know, and we like to think of ourselves as engaging in new, deeper feats of value clarification, where we're now coming to understand more deeply what we really need. Okay, and of course, you know, what does happen is all enormous discourses do get developed that do justify this move. So you are able to articulate after a while all these, you know, functionalities that you're able to get from the new gadgets and so forth, while forgetting the old stuff. So again, you know, the thing is the costs are paid, but then they're not accounted for, right? They don't appear on the balance sheet. They just disappear. And so then you, as you're thinking about your history, you know, or society's thinking about its history, they think it's steady progress. Right, because the things we have now best justify the kinds of lives we're now leading. But along the way, we've left a lot of stuff behind in a very systematic way. Okay, and there's no proper cost accounting done. That's kind of interesting. Now, my own view, and it's a view I held 25 years ago, is I think that's constitutive of progress. That progress is about adapting that mentality. It's about somehow getting your mind, you know, so that there is a lot of forgetting of a very systematic kind. Okay, I don't want to go any further than that. Okay, but and I think the issue that's up for us, because my view about adaptive preference formation is actually not negative. I don't know how people read what I've been saying, but I'm not negative on this. It is true, it is presented as normally negative because it does involve people ignoring or forgetting in very strategic ways things that perhaps they should not ignore or forget. But my view is I think it's an open question whether that's a bad thing. Okay? And if you look at a collective project like the History of Science in the West, I don't think it's necessarily a failure having adopted this strategy toward its past. And I think that there's an interesting discussion to be had about that. So I'll stop there.
Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. Thank you.
Can I open the floor up, please? Any questions to say?
Yeah. There's one here. Hey there.
It just struck me while we were talking through this about the ideas of progress and health, and I had two thoughts. One was, and this feeds back to the previous presentation as well. You had a slide up about controlling the natural world, and somebody saying about whether we were trying to control the natural world, and it struck me that actually the whole history of health is not really about controlling disease, it's just about shifting it to different types of disease, and the whole kind of rhetoric about, oh, well, we cured these diseases, you know, actually...
Yeah, the boundaries are being real.
So, yeah. Kind of manipulating the data, essentially, in order to project this idea of progress that may not, may be an illusion. But also, so there's that one, and then also thinking about this idea of adaptive preferences. And in the context of talking about recovery, it seems that actually that process of forgetting and reformulating and re-understanding your past is often talked about, especially among kind of user groups and recovery movements. I'm thinking about the kind of cancer groups and so on, where, you know, you kind of take your cancer as a lesson or a gift, and
exactly.
Something that you then reformulate. So there seems to be a lot of overlap there.
Yeah, yeah. No, no.
And at that really embodied level as well.
Yeah. No, no. I agree. And I would say, you know, with regard to what you say about the constant redefinitions of disease and health and so forth, well, the same thing applies also if you were looking at the history of the economics with regard to how you get economic indicators for policy purposes. Mm-hmm. You know, so quality of life indicators and things like that. Obviously, as you change your sense of what a quality life is, mm-hmm. right? Various indicators start going in and out of fashion, and how they're actually, you know, compiled start to change as well. So there's, across the board in all these sort of social sciences, there's all this kind of activity. But it's often very subtle, right? And the people who are doing it, you know, it's not the kind of thing people talk about publicly, but it just sort of happens beneath the radar, as it were. And you have to, and this is where the historians become very valuable in actually going back there and excavating and doing, as it were, snapshots of what it is that people mean by disease in 1830 versus 1850 versus 1870 and so forth. Yeah. Yes, sir.
Does the idea of science being this continuous adaptive process only work if you treat the category of science as stable?
Yes. So, yes, that's right.
If you disaggregate that, then is there problems in that approach?
Yes, no, you're absolutely right. No, that is, in fact, one of the issues. And one of the things that people in my field have tended to do when they do the history is to, in a way, implicate science as part of the just normal... You know, in other words, what determines the course of science? Is it this kind of, you know, internal trajectory, right, that the scientists themselves think, or is it more the kind of stuff happening in the other aspects of society where science is embedded at a given time, which then pushes it in various ways? And the answer is the latter, okay? Which does, in the end, if you take that seriously, make it very difficult to come up with some sort of autonomous view of science, right? Because we often talk in the history and philosophy of science, we talk about the autonomy of science, like the autonomy of the person, right? Who can talk about a sense of progress because they're self-determining. Right, you know, I lay out my goals, my objectives, and I'm meeting them to a certain extent or not, and then I'm going to improve upon them. Right, this is how we want to tell the history of science. Like the autonomous person, we have the autonomous science. Yeah, and this is why when Kuhn wrote his book, he basically said that the only discipline that can really pull this off with any degree of historical fidelity at all, and even then limited, is physics. Yeah. Yes, sir.
On exactly that point, I mean, I was just going to ask. So why do you think it's so tempting to think for scientists, for science, and for people to think about science in this way, in the same way as I think about, which might also be false, about my life having a sort of telos, an end, you know, a trajectory that was closer to a straight line and less like being, you know, less like ping pong, a pinball machine.
Well, to be honest with you, I do think this is a legacy of the Abrahamic traditions. I mean, if you want to get... That's the answer I would give in terms of, if you really... You're right, because it's not a cross-cultural thing. I mean, there's a sense in which it's a very interesting feature, but I think that's where it really comes from. And where do you see it originally, before in science, is if you go back to the predictions of the millennium, okay? Because you got a lot of guys who are reading the Bible, you know, as still happens today, reading the Bible like some kind of... scientific document, or basically saying, okay, world's going to come to the end at this point based on the kind of numerology that I've been able to decode in the Bible, and damn, it doesn't happen. Okay, now that didn't end Christianity in the Middle Ages. If anything, right, it led to a kind of revival, right, and intensification But also a reluctance to make predictions, but rather to start thinking in terms of, you know, what we would now call, you know, truth-making signs. You know, what makes it more likely that we're actually getting to where we're supposed to go? And so it's very rare, actually, you know, so these guys, these radical guys that Festinger were studying, one of the reasons why they were kind of interesting was they were still in the prediction business. Right, but the point is, if you're smart on this, you're not. Right, what you're talking about is whether things are heading in the right direction, signs that things are heading in the right direction. And this kind of rhetoric, this kind of way of thinking about time and your relationship between your knowledge, what you know now, and what you would like to happen in the future, gets picked up by science in the Enlightenment. Okay, that's when the translation occurs. Right, it's in the Enlightenment. But if you want to say what the traumatic event was, is the failure of the millennium. Right, which a lot of people were, because you know the Bible was always, you know, was seen by those who could read, was seen as a pretty rationalistic document. Okay, you know, so people were like doing all kinds of things on the basis of it. They still do, of course. But that was it. And when that failed, and you do start to get this very interesting theological discussion going on about what is true about it, what's not true, you know, but that doesn't stop them from believing. Right, they just get more sophisticated, and then they move forward collectively, and they start spreading the word. Yes, sir.
Can I bring back some words of John's, which is about species-specific progress? A point he was making about we're not going to destroy the world, but we might destroy ourselves as a species. So, could we use the end of the species as some marker of failure, and how near we are to that end?
Yeah.
You know, to invert this and say, rather than progress, are we coming to the end of our life as a species, and could that be something as a benchmark to test where we're going and whether we're doing any good?
Well, I suppose, look, if you're against the story I'm telling, that's exactly what you do, right? But if you're for the story I'm telling, you got a different angle on this.
Okay.
I think at the moment, we're sort of imagining that, there are a couple of issues. First of all, whether a desirable life requires using all of the energy that we're using at the moment, because all the sort of nightmare scenarios do presuppose everybody's going to go lockstep like America, right? There's that issue, but there's also kind of a, you might say intellectually more interesting issue, which is what if people decide, given the way in which they can fulfill their lives, let's say through through information and communication technologies, then they don't really think their biological bodies are all that up to much. Right? So in other words, there's no intrinsic value in living as long as possible, as healthily as possible in the kind of canonical sense. Right? That kind of ideal might just go by the wayside. So there's a sense in which one doesn't, you know, that might solve the pensions crisis, for example, right? People might find that living fast, dying young is more where it's at. And that might mitigate a lot of these problems. You see what I mean?
Some people doing it already.
Yeah, of course they are. And I just think, you know, what you need, you know, but this is why I say the whole business about our needs and how those needs are satisfied is very fluid. And if we don't, you know, the thing that we should learn from the history of capitalism is that you could take, a relatively constant human need, like let's say transport, and you could come up with products which really cause people to rearrange their behavior in massively different ways. Okay, but nevertheless, think they're still satisfying the same need, right? And they're willing to pay a price. And the thing, and the clever thing that the entrepreneur can do is figure out the price. You see, because sure, we cannot continue in our current form forever. Nobody doubts this. But maybe people are willing to trade off a few things, and they may be able to, and part of it may involve reinterpreting their needs in terms of more ecologically sound. But maybe one needs to get very radical and saying, why do you need to live so long? Do you really think that living long is really going to get you everything you want? You know, maybe if I can give you everything you want next week, you'll be happy to go.
Give me a chance. Just go ahead.